You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I'm here today and honored to be here with Maurice Sendak, who, although he needs no introduction, will receive one from me, author of Where the Wild Things Are and Outside Over There and In the Night Kitchen, of the Dear Millie book, and recently illustrator of a book by his father in Grandpa's house. Well-beloved and in Los Angeles, having seen here the debut of Higgledy Piggledy Pop as an opera, as well as a revival of Where the Wild Things Are. He is here designing Mozart's Idomeneo for the LA Opera Company, and we are very happy to have you here.
Thank you.
This begins, I guess, or continues, rather, an involvement with Mozart. You designed a magic flute, I think.
Yep, we did a magic flute. And the only other Mozart Frank Cossaro and I did was Loca del Cairo, which is a fragment, a mere unfinished hunk, which we designed for New York City. But this is this will be our second major Mozart, and we have a third major Mozart for his anniversary. That's our anniversary present to Wolfgang next year. Our version of La Clemenza di Tito.
So these are the three M's, I gather. Maurice, Mickey, and Mozart.
Hey, I like that.
Tell me, you've described the making of children's books as being a process that's like composing. Is the making of an opera a process that's like writing children's books?
Oddly, yes. It's more like illustrating children's books, because the illustrator of the book, I always tell students, and I don't think they ever believe me, is backseat driver, meaning you're not preeminently number one in the project. That language is. And pictures are there to embellish, buoy up, and make more magnificent the words. Of course, you look terrific if you do that well, but primarily you're secondary to the process. And as a stage designer, you're definitely secondary. So if the conceit is you are illustrating Mozart by designing an opera, then you are very careful not to plaster yourself all over the place or push yourself in front of the music or do anything obscene like get in the way of Mozart. So again, it's similar in the sense that you're backseating again. You're making the thing look sound, whatever, terrific, but you're definitely back there. It's not so modest as I make it sound, because you can do an awful lot of shtick, but you definitely have to know where you are in the lineup.
Well, Higgledy Piggledy Pop was one of the transfiguring experiences of my life. When I was sitting there watching that opera, I was laughing and crying and feeling so buoyant and joyful.
Oh, you know, I'm delighted.
It's a philosophical opera like Voltaire.
Gee, I wish it were.
Oh, truly, you know it is.
I know it's a wonderful work.
It's a great piece of work. Now, I have no doubt that children seeing that would be in ecstasies and wished that there had been more performances, because I knew of children and adults that I wanted to round up and bring. What is the likelihood? Children are famous for screaming and squalling and saying, "I won't go to the opera. I won't. I won't." What will happen with Mozart?
Well, if nobody tells them that this is a very important and difficult opera seria, they might just go to have fun. They won't know. That's the wonderment of children. They don't know anything about the history of it, so they just go with quite open minds. If they don't like it, you know within minutes they spend the entire opera in the bathroom or coughing or crying or nagging. Normally, like, the worry of children coming to Wild Things, I remember when it was premiered, because the music is dissonant and difficult, as though children know that. As though children know that as different from classical or romantic or whatever. They'll just go. If they love it, they love it, and if they don't, they don't. And the remarkable thing has been they're entranced. I mean, they'll sit for an hour with their jaws gaping, not just at the visual, but the oral, Because it is a great work in the sense it all comes together as a unified, harmonious thing. And because it's complicated, and because it's rich, and because it doesn't condescend to them, and it doesn't humiliate them, and it reflects something which is true of all their lives. It's real stuff.
Well, Wild Thing was like being on a ride in Disneyland. There was no, you know. But for me, the chef d'oeuvre was Higgledy Piggledy Pop.
Well, it is for me, too, because it's a book of mine that I admire a good deal more than Wild Things. It came any number of years later. Came in a very colossal moment in my life. It's my longest work. It's my most serious work. It's the funniest thing I've ever done. Frank Cosaro calls me Morose Sendak. So when I do a book with some laughs in it, I'm very pleased. And then to have met Ali Nussin, who did Wild Things, the music, that is, and his grasp of both the seriousness and the comicness, but more the largeness of the piece. He never thinks of it as a children's piece. I never think of it as a children's piece, meaning something reduced. Makes it a remarkable work. I don't think there's another piece like Higgledy around, really.
Oh, no. And when at the end, I mean, the book, for all of its greatness, only performs Higgledy Piggledy Pop once,
right.
But there are encores and 1,001th performances yes. of Higgledy
yes.
Piggledy.
See, that's where the opera much improves on the book. Much improves on the book.
I was doing it for the rest of the night. And I didn't even have the impetus of a salami mop. I wanted to, well, begin to talk about some of the children's books and maybe to begin by stepping on one of your famous punchlines. I was not surprised to read that the Wild Things came to you in the guise of unfavorite aunts and uncles. I mean, they look like my unfavorite aunts and uncles, and I think I know how they behaved.
Yeah, they all behave the same. They pinch and maul you and squeeze you and say dreadfully inane things, and the worst thing they say is, we could eat you up, and you know they could eat anything. And do eat anything.
Well, mine often sat on the floor and said, do you remember when I was a little girl? And then proceeded to show what it was like, and it was more horrible. but these are, in some way, family books. And I think that what children feel it, families perhaps feel threatened by them. Am I right in thinking that they are sort of your family albums?
Yes, not in the autobiographical sense at all. I'm not writing down incidents that I remember. But certainly in the subtext feeling sense, yes, this is all familiar territory to me. None of these things literally happened to me. I was never as brave as Max, ever. I never talked to my mother that way. But in a sense, yes, it's all Brooklyn, and it's immigrants, and it's the color and smell and feel of my childhood back in Brooklyn. That's what it is. It's all I knew. I remember when I first began as a young illustrator, and I brought my work about to publishers, I kept a little book of criticism, which fortunately I kept, and it said, you draw badly, and your people look like from the other side. So look at contemporary children's books, meaning look at books with blonde children and upturned noses, and I'd never seen people like that.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, I live in the Fairfax district of Los Angeles, and I feel such a relief to get back there every night because the people look the way they looked when I was growing up. They look mm-hmm. like they grew up underground. They look shaped like roots and, you know,
yeah.
have
it is
gnarls
relief, isn't
and
it?
Whorls. Yeah.
Yeah. Scary being in Los Angeles.
You mentioned that where In the Night Kitchen worked on at least two levels, that when you were working on Outside Over There, you felt that it was resonating on three levels
yeah.
at least. What did you mean then?
Well, I think I meant all levels. It was the book I was reaching for. It was the most difficult book that would be the trilogy. It would be the most personal of all the books. It would probably be perhaps the end of the picture book cycle for me. In a large sense, it has been. I've not written a picture book since Outside Over There, nor have I felt inclined to. It's the one I wanted. It's as good as I could get it. it's my personal favorite, but it misses, of course. because to get it would have meant I was reading the letters of Melville. All spring I've been reading Herman Melville.
How lucky.
I've not felt well, and I've been home, and I remember when I was very young. I'll get back to the point, I promise, but I've always loved him very much, but in moments of travail, a crisis, I seem to just lean on him. And I was reading his letters, and he speaks of diving. That's one of his favorite words. And when you work, you must dive. Of course, what he means by that is you can land on your head and break it, and it's a risk. And I think outside over there was a tremendous risk for me. I dove as deep as I could go, and I could only wish I'd gone deeper, but that book was so painful and ultimately immensely satisfying.
Well, you remember what Melville then said to Sophia Hawthorne after Moby Dick and before Pierre, to Sophia, who said, I liked your book about the whale. He said, well, my next book will be a goblet of country cream.
No, I think...
but to Hawthorne, who knew more than that it was a book about the whale, said, yes, there is Leviathan, but there are also the Kraken.
Yeah. I think it was a rural bowl of milk.
A rural, that's it.
A rural bowl of milk. And you think, what could he have been imagining telling someone he liked Sophia Hawthorne? Because Pierre is the most demented rural bowl of milk ever served up any dish ever. But I guess he meant it. I guess he meant it.
But truly one of the great unread, but by now great and unread seem to be hand-in-hand words, you know.
Especially with someone like Melville. I mean, how many, next year is his anniversary too, along with Mozart's, another big M coming up. And there's so little of him that we know about still. It's as though just as when he was living, his family protected him like a ring round him, all those Dutch people surrounding their Herman. So have we determined to not tell the story of Herman Melville.
And so many beautiful episodes in that story. I mean, from the moment in Moby Dick where he says of the place that Queequeg comes from, it is not found on any map, two places never are, to that final moment when they found the desk that he kept in the customs house with a tiny note with a little scroll saying, stay true to the dreams
of your youth.
God. You know, truly, you know, an amazing, amazing thing. Melville is probably my favorite American writer.
Me too. And unfortunately, he can't be illustrated. Cannot touch him.
Not even some of the short stories,
no.
The turtles?
No. You mean the incantatas?
The incantatas, yeah.
No. I mean, he's such a graphic writer. I mean, you see everything he wishes you to see, so then you're just second best to him, which is not a good place to be. So you can't. I think Rockwell Kent, illustrating the whale, is the only one who's come close to doing pictures that are reasonably okay for Moby Dick. No, you can't do anything for Herman Melville.
I sometimes think, you can correct me, you will know better, obviously, but, you know, people don't know when they read The Confidence Man what a vaudeville it is.
Yeah.
And I do sometimes...
Or how funny Moby Dick is.
Or how funny Moby Dick is, for that matter. I do somehow think that an illustrator, maybe this would be tipping the hand, could let a reader know what a shuffle of the cards the Confidence Man is.
But you're right, it's tipping the hand. It's pushing it just in the way he would have not wished, but he worked so hard not to push.
Like Kafka asking for no picture of the cockroach.
In the same way Henry James saying he'd come back from the dead and kill anybody who illustrated him. And he was right, because in any direction you'd go, you'd be upsetting this miraculous apple cart.
Yes, yes. And even Edward Gorey, who does a couple of decent ones, doesn't come even close.
No, my favorite writers are the one I can't do pictures for.
What's your favorite James?
My favorite James would maybe be The Ambassadors.
Mm-hmm. Late James.
Yeah, late James. Oh, I love... some of my favorite ones are about children, like What Maisie Knew and The Awkward Age. I mean, I don't... It's strange how much he knows about children. I don't know that he's as well-known as he should be for his insights, especially into little girls who watch their parents grow up, or rather, not grow up. and corrupt them.
Or that boy and the pupil who faints at the end of the story into his teacher's lap. Incredible.
So the children in James are most extraordinary, and I don't. There must be a book on the children in James, but I've never come across it.
I haven't seen it either. The best thing I know on James, I think, is the Poirier book, The Comic Sense of Henry James. It's awfully good.
It's very good.
I'm talking to Maurice Sendak, and we've diverged into American literature, but we are going to go right back into children's literature now as I ask. you say, are persuasive in your books, that the best things are the things that the pictures tell us that the author has not said. Now, in Outside Over There, I live in continued fear of those unmentioned by the text yellow flowers that are clustering in on the at the window on the left and really seem to be more demonic a force than the goblins. Where do they come from?
Well, to be honest, I ripped them off. They come from my favorite early German romantic painter. His name is Philipp Otto Runge. And along with Caspar David Friedrich, who is the most well-known painter of that period, Otto Runge painted children that are extraordinary. He's a Hamburg painter, and most of the pictures are in the Kunsthalle in Hamburg. And his picture, his depiction of children is extraordinary, because it's hard to imagine anybody in the 18th century understanding children that way, except Mozart, perhaps. So there's a painting called the Hülsenbecker Kinder of three children playing in a field, and sunflowers are surrounding them. The sunflowers are so alive and vibrant. They reach for the children, and the flesh on the baby's arm reaching for the sunflower, and the sunflower reaching for the baby's arm. I just fell in love with that. And so my sunflowers come from him, but of course I use them for another device entirely, as a rather frightening device in the Outside Over There.
Well, it's a very odd thing. That lingers on the mind, and that the mysterious missing bonnet that is on the ice changeling, but when baby comes home is sitting waiting at mama in the arbor's side.
You know,
yellow
why.
Too. No, you tell me why. That's well, exactly what I was going to ask.
It's Ida's feverish fantasy, and she's clumsy in her fantasy about the logistics of certain items. The thing has never moved from any place but the arbor. They haven't ever gone away from picture number one. It took her 2 seconds to fantasize the whole piece.
Well, you've just answered my next question, but I'm going to ask it anyway for everyone else. In the other books, famously in Where the Wild Things Are, the pictures get larger and larger and larger, and finally hit the double page folders, and it's sort of the feeling of the book becoming as big as the world, or the book becoming as big as the forest that's growing up around Max's bed. In Outside Over There, the book begins with a crash, with an immediate full-page illustration, and then the illustrations get smaller. Now I think I know the answer as to why, because this is the setting ground for the girl's fantasy. Is
correct.
That? Okay.
and her fantasy is congested and tight and feverish. And so the pictures take on that congested, tight, feverish, I hope, look. Whereas Max, his rage is expanding, his total revolt against being locked in his room. His temper is exploding, and so the pictures just swell with him. And then when he's tired, they just go boomp, like a balloon. Like any kids, he just wants to go home and eat and forget about the whole thing.
A 72-year-old circulation librarian, and as scary and alligator-like as that phrase implies, tells me that the best phrase in all children's literature is "let the wild rumpus start."
Yep. It's been even used by Stephen King in one of his novels, which I say unflattered. He's used a number of expressions from my books in various novels.
I'm told by my associate producer that the line that makes them scream, though, is, "And Maurice said, excuse me. And Max said no.
In
Wild Things. Now, when you say that you have no inclination now to do another picture book, what does that mean?
Well, I will do another picture book, but I don't know that I will write and illustrate another picture book. I feel very sanguine about having finished that phase of my life. I'm very much a stage designer now, and I will periodically go back for a very special book like Dear Millie. I had to have Dear Millie, but I haven't done any picture books since Outside Over There. I've been designing for the stage, and now I'm phasing opera out of my life gradually, and I'm beginning a children's theater of my own. Which I will administer. I will be the artistic director, and I want to present complicated, virile, exciting works for children that are not reductive and not all the things we said earlier,
wonderful.
This is something I wanted to do for quite some time, and it's been a very difficult achievement because it doesn't depend on me. It depends on being funded, and we've just begun to be funded.
Oh, promise me it will be something that I can see.
Definitely. The best example to give you is what happened to you with Higgledy Piggledy Pop is what I would wish to happen in my productions, that they be that complicated so that the kids are getting supreme nourishment, but so is everybody else.
Yeah. Have you ever read this wonderful romantic play by Ludwig Tieck called Die Gestefelte Karte? It's his version of Puss in Boots.
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's an incredible thing. It's a version in which an audience of adults and children are sitting in front of a production of Puss in Boots, and the people in the audience are objecting to what the story they're mm-hmm. being told. You think we're children? Even the children are saying, do you think we're children? They do not want to hear Puss in Boots. And the play is about the interaction of the audience with
the Puss
in Boots story.
Like yes, the other stories, you're going to have to give me a reading list.
I promise.
Yeah.
it's the job of being, you know, an eccentric. I finally... none of my favorite books, I suspect very few of yours, are books that you would read having gone to school. And
never.
This is the enormous objection that one has if one is a bookworm, that to be educated in America is not to know the best things of all.
No, in fact, just the opposite. I mean, to suffer painfully through the reading of great works and then to hate them permanently, which is usually the case.
I wanted to ask you about Randall Jarrell on the subject. Almost is delivered at his door in Sad Heart at the supermarket. Mm-hmm. He talks a great deal about the poverty of children reading books that are, you know, impoverishing to their hearts and their minds and their souls. The books that you did for him, along with those for Ruth Krauss, seem to me of the collaborations, they warm my heart the most. So I kind of project. Mm-hmm. Are they special to you?
Yep. I would add just one more: the books by Els Minerich, the Little Bear
Little
books.
Little Bear. Of course.
Yeah, it's a different kind of book. But I was very lucky when I was young because I worked with dynamic writers who allowed me into the process. I wasn't the mere illustrator. I was the kid that they were training. I was the apprentice to Ruth Krauss and the friend of Randall Jarrell and the pal of Elsa Minerich. But probably of the three, the most original and sensational was the one with Randall, because we went to the opera together and I admired him so much. I was a little intimidated by him, I admit, because I was afraid of poetry, and he helped me with that problem a good deal.
And
too. I'm still afraid of poetry, and I'm still trying to get over this hobgoblin of poetry is too complicated for me to understand. I've had that since childhood. And it's a funny, quirky thing, and I remember the discussions with Randall.
It can change, you know. I'll tell you, for many years, there were many things that I didn't know, and I refused to take poetry classes in school. And then one day, a poem happened to me. I assumed that people who liked poetry were lying. I really did. I thought it was...
A big phony thing.
I thought it was a big phony thing that grown-ups talked about. And in the same way that once, finally, after probably my millionth viewing, I was with every single moment of Buster Keaton's... great Civil War comedy. What was the
about the train?
About the train. The general.
The general. Yeah.
And finally, it happened, and I was with it at every moment. One day, a poem happened to me in that way, and after that, it was when I was reading poetry. I kind of closed my eyes and remember what had happened when I had read Charlie Simic's poems about the fingers of the hand, and different poems about forks and spoons and knives, and I would even let his poems lead me anywhere into Wordsworth, into preposterously difficult poetry.
I want to get into Wordsworth. That's where I want to go. I want to go to the prelude. I want to go to the prelude because I feel I'm destined to do something, to draw pictures. And I know, and it's so difficult. It's like a maze to get to Wordsworth. I'm so frightened. Literally, I'm not being hyperbolic. I don't know how to get there. I really don't know how to get there.
Well, I think the first thing is, you know, a good teacher sometimes, but so often you have to find the good teacher in yourself, you know.
And I'm 62. I mean, where am I going to find a teacher at this point in my life? Although that's probably fatuous because the teacher could be a much younger person and probably would be better for it. But it must happen. I've been reading Wordsworth biographies and Coleridge's biographies and trying to inch my way into their lives and inch my way into their rooms and get there. And I can do some of the things now, but I can't get over the still ancient, paralyzing fear that these are beyond me. The little boy from Brooklyn will never figure this stuff out.
We will continue this discussion on our next show. I'm talking to Maurice Sendak, author of Where the Wild Things Are, In the Night Kitchen, Outside Over There, and visiting Los Angeles to design the LA Opera's production of Idomeneo, which is going to be opening in September. We are thrilled to have him here, and we will be talking to him again on our next show. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. My engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Talk to you again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ices, throw in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books. Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now in the book of the mouse, pop, die.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.